Welcome to the IAB UK podcast.
Hello, James here, and you're listening to the IAB UK podcast. Today, it's a conversation for football lovers everywhere. Whether you're a diehard fan, an armchair supporter, or only really get involved when there's a big tournament on, we're kicking off the Euro 2024 chat this week, ahead of a summer where England will dare to delight and maybe, just maybe, will even win the thing. And don't worry, there's very little in the way of Vindaloo and Three Lions and much more on how brands can tap into the fandom surrounding what will be one of the biggest men's football tournaments in the world. And I'm joined by Ginny Dobson, VP of Commercial and Operations at Football Co., John Cole, Head of Global Client and Agency Solutions at LiveScore, and Alex Brown, Head of Sport and Entertainment at Essence MediaCom UK. And there's loads we get into, like how brands can navigate influencer partnerships with players themselves or with content creators, how they can use live data to really capitalize on the big moments from the games, and how can those much smaller budgets still have a big impact. But first, I started off by asking John, how does fan and viewer behaviour change during big tournaments, and how does it compare with league football?
Yeah, look, I think there's a different element of jeopardy that comes in it with league football. Obviously, with international football, it's got more of a unifying behaviour that sits behind it. And also, we tend to see anywhere up to like a 33% increase in users coming on during that period of time. So really indicative of that unifying part of it. And there's a really interesting stat that when we've done the insight into it, that you've got 37% of our users that actually value that sense of community across the nation during that period of time. So that unifying element and the power of positivity that comes along with it, especially as the players seem more tangible than maybe the golden generation had gone before, has certainly very much positive impact on those behaviours and the way things change as well.
I've got a feeling we're going to come back to golden generation and things like that, aren't we? Very sadly, for anyone listening who's slightly tormented by the golden generation, of which you probably were, Alex.
Indeed. I think for me, the big tournaments come along and John mentioned community and so on and so forth, but you can imagine this summer, pubs will be packed. When England are playing, particularly Scotland are playing, WhatsApps will be flying around with your mates. It is about community. Mm-hmm. That's what a big tournament does. And I think in terms of fan behaviour or fan viewership, it exacerbates what we're seeing from an insights perspective around more women watching. They always follow more big tournaments. Or young people who are, you know, by virtue, are casual fans. They follow players, they follow teams, they follow the whole tournament, and they are casual fans who are second screening whilst they're watching and so on and so forth. So the summer is, any big tournament is always a community feel to it.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
So much of it feels like it'll be kind of the same of what we expected before. But I mean, you talked about, just for example, increase in women watching. Anything different? Is there going to be anything different about this tournament where we might see for the first time, or a real shift in audiences or how people are watching?
Yeah, I do think so. I think, you know, particularly if you look at the fan groups, there's so many different diverse types of fan groups. There's like just the big tournament watchers, the casual fans. Like, you've got so many different subsections, and I think within that you'll definitely see more women watching.
And I wonder if the Lionesses and Euros and World Cup, whether that sort of galvanised a new type of fan as well that might be more likely to tune into the men's game.
Definitely, in the success that England had, the optimism around it. I think you've got to also look at, you know, the last men's Euros we had was coming straight off of COVID, and, you know, what you said about that real community, people, you know, looking forward to being able to actually properly celebrate it together. But I don't think that's necessarily just all around the live games. For instance, we did a study towards the end of last year, a big brand piece around the Euros, and I think it's 38% of fans said their enjoyment of the tournament wouldn't be impacted by them relying on watching the live games. And I think it taps really into that. There's this whole piece where some fans just follow it purely through social and that enjoyed experience with friends, with family, whoever. And I think that's a really interesting thing to come out of this tournament.
I think it's a really important point. It's also that it's not following it just via linear TV, although that is the key part, and it's always an appointment to view in terms of the big games. But it's also about the social, and that is where actually that diverse audience, particularly women, and as I say, Gen Zs and the younger fans, are very much following tournaments much more on the social medias, the memes, the GIFs, all of the extra stuff around the games. The 90 minutes is critical. Obviously, the result means you laugh or cry or whatever, but it's also everything else around it. And the tournament starts, you know, a month out or at least 2 or 3 weeks out. And then it goes through the whole tournament, and in and around every single game, there is that social element, exacerbated with the female audience particularly.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, the digital enablement, if you like, to be able to, I mean, people talk about second screen in a lot, but you've got a diversity of places that you can do that in, but also that affects actually your consumption of the games themselves. He tapped on earlier about the highlight side of it. There's huge propensity for that community to understand highlights. Gen Z and millennials hugely tap into that and utilise that, as well as looking at sort of that greater media mix to come into play and to utilise in that sense, because you see it across social media, you see it across apps, but you also see changes in behaviour from streaming behaviours as well. I mean, we've been fortunate enough to have the Champions League over the past few seasons, and what you tend to see is people coming in when they're streaming via mobile for sort of 20-minute sessions and then coming in and out, and usually around sort of key moments, if you like. Yeah. But some of those key moments are decided by the push notifications that are going out to signify that there's been a goal, a VAR decision, a card, and they're coming in to watch those elements. Yeah. So to that point, it's not necessarily always about the patterns of play and everything that's going on. It's actually those key elements that become the talking points and then drive the social currency and the memes and everything else off the back of it.
And I wonder if there's this immediacy now, like highlights packages, when done through linear TV, one, you have to wait for them to be put together, two, they're quite meaty, you know, in sort of 6, 7, 10 minutes. Now there's just this complete immediacy. Something happens and it's packaged up and it's sort of 10 seconds, this TikTokification of kind of stuff that's happening. There is, comes with this, John, just this avalanche of new data that we're seeing as well. How do you think advertisers in particular can start to leverage some of this data for the benefit of the people that they want to reach?
I think it's about staying agile, in all honesty, and then being with a partner that you can trust the data that's coming from those platforms. We're very fortunate we're owned and operated in terms of the app. So we see everything happen in absolute real time. So the data that we can take out of that, and then the narratives that you can start to identify and bring advertisers in and on that journey with, is as immediate as we can kind of leverage it. I mean, obviously there's that part of it where you want to create a reactive content, but so often that's created in advance because you've got an idea of what the narratives are going to be.
Yeah.
And I feel for our social team at times because they've created all this content and it will never see the light of day because it never happened during that period of time. But having that data and that analytics, understanding what the narratives are and fundamentally trusting the partner that has that data can utilise that. But the other part of it is to understand where you want to be. Is it pre, during or post, or is it touch points and all? And I think being clear about the data that you can pull out in those environments can really define the success of a campaign and how you're aligned with that brand's objectives.
I think for me, the key word that John mentioned there is agility when it comes to brands. And what we're advising our clients is, you know, in this new communications economy of fragmented media and how people are consuming the tournaments, is still the fundamental intersection between what the insight is telling you, what the data is telling you. Plan in advance, get a good creative. Absolutely, you've got to get the creative right. But then be agile enough and flexible enough to then react to what's happening within the tournament. And, you know, we did it with the guys at Football Co. last year with Google, is like the influencer-led reactive content absolutely flies. And there are so many ways for a brand to be reactive and be flexible.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most critical thing.
But these things don't happen by accident. You kind of have to set yourself up for this success, don't you?
Totally.
It's reactive planning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You say it's reactive, but actually I remember as England were progressing through, we started those very early on. It was like code gold and code red. Like, which one are we going to be going with? And good job, it was like code gold towards the end. And, you know, we had a plan ready in place to react to that. So I think it's all in the planning, but being reactive planning, if that makes sense.
Tell me about cut-through, Ginny, because there's so many layers to a big tournament like this. There's sort of the official sponsors, there's the players themselves, which are far more capable now, have their own teams of doing stuff. How can brands really cut through lots of the noise, perhaps as well if you can't afford to be or not big enough to be one of the main broadcast sponsors?
Yeah, I think the beauty is that, like, there's so many different ways you can approach it, and we work with brands on either side of the spectrum. So whether you are an official partner and you do the big play stuff, whether you're an unofficial partner and you want to do the big play stuff, but also if you're a smaller brand and you want to cut through, I think that's where it really ties back to those fan segments. Not trying to get everyone at once. Like, you're not going to be everything to everyone. Really be focused and targeted in who you're trying to speak to. And I think doing it in a really authentic way. Like, people are so used to it now. Like, they can see where, you know, it's just a stunt, or, you know, you're not doing it for the long term. I think that was the beauty of the Google Pixel FC campaign, is that we set out with an objective that was, we want to really champion and push female creators in the space, and not just as one-time thing. It was like, this is the long-term goal. And I think we saw off the back of it, one of the creators, she turned full-time. She was doing two jobs. She was working as a nurse and doing creators on the side. And as part of the program, you see her, she's doing it full-time now. So I think, yeah, there's so many different opportunities, but I think really being like clear in who you're trying to target is going to help you cut through.
Yeah. And there's different ways of leveraging talent, I guess. The Muller-Declan Rice tie-up is a good one. I mean, do we still have Muller-Rice? Is that still around? Because that would have been perfect for
him. Well, that was all for Muller-Rice. And look, I mean, that's a really good example of where a brand has just been very authentic around their product integration, if you like. And the Google example, again, is another one whereby it was about a long-term goal of visibility of women's football. And how could Google add to that? Well, they've got a brilliant device, a handset that they could use to get more women's football consumed and watched by their target audience and the wider society. And the same with Muller and Declan Rice. It was a, you know, you could argue a little bit of a stunty, fun campaign, but equally there was an influencer, Jack Mate, and there was Declan Rice, who was an influencer in his own right, put them together, rework a 90s ad, you know, I'm not going to sing it. Rice, baby. And, you know, you've got a wonderful way of kind of exposing Muller Rice to, and Muller the brand to, a broader audience around a football tournament.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because it's about embracing the context, the environmental context that sits around it. And you've got such a rich area to actually get into. And I think what you mentioned previously regarding, you know, using phones, sometimes I think production values go in too heavy.
Yeah.
When actually the fans or what empower the tournament, the fans, or what you're trying to get to. So, you know, as you said earlier, they can tell when they're being sold to. They know when something's too highly polished. They know when there's something that's too definitive a narrative about it. So don't lose sight of that, and don't go too heavy on the production values and trying to get the message across, because they'll back out of it. They won't want to be involved with it.
Yeah, and it's almost like we've sort of grown up on very high production values when it comes to football, when it comes to official sponsors, when it comes to analysis. Everything is kind of TV ready, I guess, whereas now it feels like, particularly with these younger audiences, we're in a sort of slightly different place where it can be a bit on the go and a bit scrappy.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, there's always that part, especially when you're talking, you know, in the digital sphere, it's like, if you wouldn't share it, show it, or pass it off as your own, then it doesn't drive social currency. So then what's it doing for you? What's it doing for the brand? What's it doing for the objectives?
Yeah.
The critical thing for me is that, I mentioned it earlier, that the media fragmentation is it something like 50% or 52% of time spent with media is non-ad funded? So people are consuming what they want when they want it. And John's point around, would you share it, would you consume it, is absolutely critical. And if you're a brand, for me, it's about authenticity. It's about being true and real to what you are about as a brand and bringing that to the consumer. And Ginny's point earlier around target audiences and the communities where you want to operate, you don't have to have massive budgets. You need to be really clear as to where your audience is playing and use the insight and data that you've got available to play in those environments. And there's multiple different ways to do that. Influencers, fan zones, you name it.
I tend to agree. I think targeting, you know, if you've got smaller budgets, how are you using some of the DMPs of the platforms to make sure that you're getting into those environments and making sure that you're resonating in the right way? And to Ginny's point, like, I think far too often there can be potentially a lazy approach to football fans. It becomes tropish. And I think, you know, they, again, they see that a mile off. And the diversity and inclusivity that sits within fandom, if you know where you want to play, then play in that space and don't be lazy. I mean, I've worked with creatives in the past that have never been to a football match in their entire life, or, you know, aren't a fan of a club or have no touch point. And you're coming from a different perspective at that point in time. So being part of it and understanding it is very important. It's overlooked.
Yeah, it's not all Three Lions and Vindaloo.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that.
I mean, there's a, you know, everyone loves the big ads, right? And but you go back 10, 15 years and, you know, I used to love it as a football fan back in the day. Before a big tournament, a month out, you'd have all the brands releasing their big TV ads and you would love watching them. And then they would do shorter form cut downs of those 60 second adverts and they put it on social. And that would be the way they were trying to engage with fans. The world has moved on. so, you know, massively since then. And it's now about a bit more of a, as I said earlier, an agile approach, a bit more flexible, far more nimble. And you don't have to have the big glossy ad. You can do it in many other ways.
Yeah. I think there's almost like a subcurrent to those big glossies. And there's what's going on. Like, we've coined a phrase internally, which is like, the meme is bigger than the man of the match. I don't know who I stole that from, but we have.
It's yours,
like,
now.
It is. I'm claiming it. Thanks to whoever gave me that. But there's almost, yeah, this like whole content current that's going on underneath all of that is that kind of reactive piece. And I think coming back to the businesses with smaller budgets and that, how do you get that authentic voice if it's not something you're necessarily tapped in much before? Like, you don't have to start from scratch and make the mistakes. Like, there are partners out there that, you know, have tried and tested formats or, you know, are doing existing things. Like, we're doing a week-long activation called Hotel Mundial, where it's essentially like a fan screening, and brands can get involved with that. So it's not a case of, you know, having to come up with this big thinking idea on your own. Like, you can fit into what is going on to really make your, you know, your money go a little bit further and tap into the expertise of how to do it in that authentic way.
And there'll be a plethora of opportunities, that there's no doubt. I wonder, I sort of think about things, John, like Burger King in FIFA. I think about Nike with London 2012, where they talked about London, but they talked about London in Canada and London in different places. You know, quite hacky, guerrilla thing. Not great if you're Adidas and you've paid a lot of money to sponsor the Olympics, and they're a bit sniffy-nosed about it. But is there still opportunity for those sort of slightly more guerrilla, hackable things for brands with not huge budgets to do to get some standout?
Yeah, I think so. But the kernel of it always has to come from the creative and the idea to go into that. And I think there's lots of opportunities. Ginny touched on earlier sort of subcurrents and cultures that sit within underneath that. And I think if you can identify that in the right way, then there's definitely the opportunity that's there. And I also think with some of that, you go back to the data and the immediacy that sits alongside that as well. And it's utilising that sits underneath to find where you're going to play and go and play in that space. Yeah. And Ginny's right, you know, you can lean on the experts in those fields, and whether it's publishing, whether it's in-game, whatever it might be, to find that avenue and opportunity and really tend to kind of highlight and bring that alive. But, you know, my opinion on that is it's becoming more and more challenging to find those spaces because the majority of content that's consumed in a digital space isn't from a paid partnership. So the creativity that sits within creators and influencers and everywhere like that, they're trying to spot it for their own opportunities and to create their own content and to get their own engagement. Definitely exists. You've got to be smart, but you've also got to realise there's influencers doing it all the time.
So I was going to say, I mean, to add to what John was saying, we're lucky enough to work with some clients who've got official IP in the game, skin in the game, if you like, the likes of Coca-Cola and talked Google earlier. But actually, some of my favourite campaigns are those that are a bit more guerrillery, a bit hacky, as you said. I mean, particularly, and this is an example out of China, unfortunately, not the UK, but, you know, there was a campaign around the last World Cup, which was Sprite, heat happens, stay cool. Mm-hmm. And they effectively sponsored the yellow cards that were happening in the tournament via the main live streaming platform, Migu, in China. And so every time a yellow card happened, there was, you know, discounts on Sprite bottles and so on and so forth. And it was all about, those are the heightened moments of a game yellow cards happen. And it's things like that where they had no official IP, but, you know, built a relationship with the broadcaster out in China, live streaming website, and were able to take over, you know, a key part of the game. And it's those sorts of, as you say, hacky moments that are the really cool ones. Duracell in Italy sponsored Extra Time, for example.
Very nice.
Extra Time, Extra Power, Optimum Batteries, et cetera, et cetera.
These things are the best ones, always seems.
You know, they seem so obvious, and that's the thing. I know, go back to my point earlier, is you need to plan, you need to be led by data and insights, but the minute you land on that really clear and core creative, then your campaign will fly during the summer.
There's loads going on this year, obviously. There's the Euros, Paris Olympics, there'll be Wimbledon, there'll be all the usual stuff that's happening as well. How are you advising clients who might want to play in all of those spaces? Is it try and do it all and foot up the budget for it, or is it be selective?
So we have some clients that are very much focused on the football and the Euros. We have other clients that are trying to own, or not own, but take over the summer of sport, Subway, for example, and so on. I think my key advice to any client would be that sport moves remarkably quickly. I think if England win this summer, the country will stop, let's be honest, for about a month,
everyone
will be, you know, launching from bus stops and all sorts, and probably drunk for a week. But if that doesn't happen, which I don't think it will, I think you've got to remember, and what we advise clients is, the world moves, as I say, the world of sport moves on very quickly. Yeah. 55% of sport watching is football, but that leaves 45% that is not.
Yeah.
And Wimbledon and the Olympics are really diverse opportunities to reach another completely different audience.
Yeah.
And that's what we try and remind brands, that the world doesn't revolve all around football.
It's going to be very hard when we're in the heat of the tournament and, you know, England have progressed through the group, you know, 6-0, 6-0 and 5-1. But we should talk a little bit more about that if it was going to happen, because you may have tainted it yourself, Alex. But favourites, we should talk about favourites, John. England's chances for one, and then secondly, if England don't win it, who will?
Well, currently the bookmaker's favourite is England. Whether you buy into that or not is a separate matter.
God.
By the user surveys and the info that we've got, France tend to be the favourites as it stands at the moment. And looking at Scotland, they haven't got out of the group stages in any international tournament that I'm aware of as of yet. So that is obviously going to look at something that will be a great achievement. And I say that with lots of Scottish friends, and part of the reason I say it, to be fair.
Unknowns, dark horses that could sort of do a sort of South Korea at some point.
Well, it's interesting because I've got something that's almost on the flip side, where most people expect Belgium to be the underperforming team of the tournament, which sits outside of what current perceptions might be. I mean, look, I know there's a lot of talk around why that generation didn't click and certain things haven't happened.
Jan Vertonghen's about 75 years old.
Yeah, still has a doubt. Apparently strikers don't talk to each other. There's lots going on there, but they are ticked to underperform.
Okay, very good.
But Belgium's an interesting one because they had a golden generation like England did, and they completely underperformed like England did. I'm an old football fan, growing up on a lot of heartache, penalty shootouts, crying. I can still remember it like yesterday. And I sadly think that will happen again this summer. And I think you look at what we've grown used to in the last more recent history is semi-finals and final so on and so forth. I think we'll probably get knocked out on penalties in the quarterfinals. John mentioned France. I think France will win it. I think they've got an unbelievable crop of players and superstars like Mbappe, who make the difference on the day.
Yeah, Germany, home nation, I mean, you can never write them off, but is it just not their time? Fortune's wheel, sadly, is just not on their side at the moment.
It feels like they're going, it's slightly a transitional period.
Right, okay.
Again, a bit like teams have to build. I know it sounds cliche, but it certainly seems that. But again, they've been, from what we've seen data-wise, third to third favourites, if you like.
I'm going to go against you, and I'm going to go Germany.
You know,
if it's not England, and I always laugh because there's generally not that optimistic country, I'd say, if you're liking us to America, for instance. We are so overly optimistic when it comes to these tournaments and England's chances, but I just really hope, off of the back of the Lionesses' success, that we do it this year.
I think you can never write off the Germans. That is the truth of it. And also, as home nation... Everyone knows that gives you a boost. So I think it's a fair call, to be honest, as well.
So no quite alignment apart from England going to get very far, probably choke. So it's the hope that kills us. Thank you very much, Alex, Ginny and John, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ginny Dobson from Football Co, John Cole from LiveScore and Essence Media Com UK's Alex Brown there. I very much enjoyed that. And as everyone heartily agreed on, it really is about this element of community. There's nothing better than this sense of a shared experience. And obviously the shared experience we're all hoping for is that England actually go on and win a major tournament in our lifetime, which would be pretty incredible, given that we've come so close before. Now, talking about shared experiences, you see what we've done there. The big date that you all need to have in your calendar, aside from the Euros, of course, is IAB Engage, happening Tuesday, the 4th of June at Soho Place in London. Join us for a half-day celebration of innovation, creativity, and digital in all its forms, from inspiring sessions to networking with the great and the good of the industry. It really is set to be a truly unmissable event again this year. You can book now via the link in the show notes, and remember, IAB advertisers and agencies come for free. That's it for this week. Thanks, Ginny, John and Alex. And of course, thank you very much for listening.
IAB UK, building a better future for digital advertising for the benefit of everyone.